Today, who's really calling the shots? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis. I'm latest post covering finance and property news, and I'm pleased to say that Tarek Brook is back for another Friday evening chat. Tarek, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, mate. It's good to be back.
Plenty to talk about. And the question for today is, who is really pulling the strings? And of course, the answer to that one, Trump would say, is Trump.
Well, on a global scale, it's certainly Trump, 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 isn't it? You know, he's the one holding all the cards, seemingly, and, you know, well, you know, pulling all the levers, so to speak. And everyone's just sort of manically running around behind him, just trying to react to everything. And sometimes, honestly, I feel like it's just a full-time job just keeping up with every single little development of what his policies are doing, both foreign and domestically.
Well, of course, that's his strategy. So I think when Steve Bannon had this idea of flooding. So the idea is you put so much stuff out that nobody has any chance of actually consuming it all and dissecting it all. So you can slip stuff under the radar. And I think that's what's going on at the moment. And of course, also, he does quite often push the envelope a long way and then come back again, like for example, the tariffs around Mexico and Canada, right? So he's actually made significant progress from his perspective. And what it really means is that you can actually create a huge amount of chaos and mayhem. And underneath the radar, as it were, you can do the things that you really want to do without necessarily people dissecting them as perhaps they should.
Well, I like to consider it, you know, like the sort of traditional Otto von Bismarck style realpolitik, except it's conducted in the 21st century with a really, really huge megaphone.
That's very good, absolutely. And that megaphone, of course, is being amplified through social media, and not only on Truth Social, but other platforms too. But it is worth just sort of thinking about the implications in terms of, you know, is good policy or bad policy being executed? Because, of course, not all policies are good, depending on, partly on your perspective. But then if you come back locally in Australia, you know, there's also something similar going on at the moment, I think, with again, you know, flooding. A lot of the flooding, of course, is about cost of living, judging by question time over this last week. And, you know, you can sniff the election locally.
You can. I think that we're very much in a position where we have a pseudo-election campaign where it's already kicked off. We've already seen, you know, the Dutton opposition release their, you know, their policy papers and everything like that. Not that they were especially detailed or especially like, you know, sort of, you know, steps, you know, A to B, A to F or whatever it is. It's very much sort of like, I like to say it's just been drawn in crayon, just very, very vaguely. And it's a bit of a shame, really, because you sort of want something from the opposition of, we are all the alternative government. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. Make your decision, rather than just, we'll decide after the election.
Yes, and of course, Labour has been playing up on the fact that, well, you know, you can see what we're doing, but you can't see what they're doing, other than they're going to put taxes up and they're going to actually stop doing things. But for me, the most fascinating thing is how they're playing with these numbers, these CPI numbers. And, you know, they've been... I think in question time today, there was a question from the opposition saying, what has the inflation level been over the last 3 years? In other words, since the last election. And Chalmers came back with a one-year answer. It's like, well, hang on a moment. These numbers are so rubbery anyway. And, the point I'd want to make is that with the CPI, the underlying CPI is swamped now because there have been so many support mechanisms, electricity and, you know, changes to the medical costs and rental assistance, that actually some of the headline inflation adjustments that have come through are seeping through into the underlying, which may or may not persuade the RBA to cut in February.
The pressure is definitely on the RBA at this stage, I feel. I think that, which is funny if you think about it, because it's like... If you had have said to someone in, say, 2019, last month we created 50,000 jobs, underlying inflation is still above the target band, and all these, and there's all these other sort of relatively positive things. I mean, like even say like real retail sales that come out earlier this week, you know, 1% growth. I mean, that is the end of the I think it was seven straight quarter real retail sales per capita contraction. So it's just funny that they've decided, oh, we're going to cut now, just as sort of things look like they might just be picking up a bit. And it's quite, one feels like there's a lot of politics involved in it, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I know the RBA says that it's looking through and et cetera, but there is significant policy. Of course, they're changing the board constructions, a couple of new people coming in next time. Although whether that will really have an impact is an interesting question. I suspect it will have some influence. But look at the Bank of England. Of course, the Bank of England actually decided to drop their interest rate by 25 basis points yesterday, despite the fact that they're forecasting inflation is going to rise up to 3.7% over the next year plus, right? And they're arguing that, well, the problem is growth is looking a lot weaker than they expected, which doesn't help the new government here in the UK. And interestingly, the question, of course, is does the RBA or does the Bank of England look at growth or not look at growth, right? Because there's an interesting question about what their mandate really is. And I've always said the problem with the central banks when their interest rate policy is they've got this sort of one lever and it's not necessarily connected very strongly to a lot of real lived experience of many people. So if you look at what's happening with inflation here in the UK and in Australia, real people are saying it's horrendous. Costs of living are really, really high. And so inflation is nowhere near where it's officially reported at, which is another problem too. So, I mean, it's a complete mess. And I come back to this theory about who's really pulling the strings. I'm not sure that anybody's really pulling the strings here.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that because I've been going through there's a paper from the ABS on rental inflation that it put out in 2023 because they basically figured out that, oh my God, there is such a huge gulf between asking rents and the CPI rental component. We better do something about it. And this is something that I think Louis Christopher may have mentioned it on your show at some point a couple of years ago. But anyway, long story short, there's a gulf has opened up between the growth in CPI rents and the growth in asking rents. And people say, well, that's because we've got this issue of measuring stocks versus flows. You're measuring what is the asking rent for a property if you were to start a tenancy today, and then you're measuring what people are actually paying. And obviously some people are still paying the same rate of rent as they were a couple of years ago. So that's why you have the issue. But in the ABS paper on this, it concluded that during the last major rental price rent growth cycle in rents, which was, sort of between about 2005 and about 2008, rents, the gap, the largest gap between the CoreLogic asking rents index in terms of cumulative total growth and the growth in the CPI rental component was about 5.6%. Today, even after accounting for the various government subsidies, which have obviously caused those to diverge further by the outside in the outsized increases in Commonwealth rent assistance, you're still looking at about around about a 20, I'm going to say about 25 to 26% gap. Yet we're already seeing CPI rents begin to moderate, which to me is just absolutely wild because that hasn't happened before to this degree. So it's just, it's I, well, that I can see within the data. I mean, unfortunately, my data set on asking rents is somewhat limited, but I think that that's just, it's really interesting just how that's occurring because if you were to actually see that rental inflation priced into the CPI, Chalmers would be having to sing quite a different tune.
Well, there's two observations. The first is I think rents and growth of rents are much more linked to income growth than many people recognize because people's capacity to pay is part of the problem here. And certainly in my analysis of rental stress, 76% of those in the rental sector have a cash flow deficit now. In other words, they don't have the capacity to pay more. And so that is definitely putting a cap on what people can actually physically get away with in terms of actually paying for accommodation. And the other interesting observation here is that if you talk to investors, and I've worked with a few investors recently and have run the cash flow numbers on a not looking at capital appreciation on the property, but just money in, money out, because of the higher costs of interest rates on those investment properties, higher insurance costs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what you're discovering is that more property investors are actually underwater from a cash flow perspective, and they're actually looking to get shot of investment properties. One reason why there's a smaller proportion of, for example, bonds in Victoria down quite considerably. In other words, the number of investment properties available are dropping. So there's a bunch of different sort of threads running underneath there economically are driving in a particular direction. But I agree with you that the reported CPI rental numbers in the ABS numbers are just disconnected, it seems to me, from what's really going on the ground.
Well, it's a bit of a shame, really, because, I mean, like, you know, they did try to fix it ostensibly. And it's just, I just think that we're, in a lot of ways, we've just been sort of flying a little blind. You know, like, first of all, we had the RBA wait to raise interest rates all the way until May 2022, when they probably should have done it a fair bit earlier. And, you know, we've just had these issues with data, really. And I mean, even with, say, for example, the ABS job series, you know, like this time last year, it was looking pretty ropey. You know, it was looking pretty dicey there. Yet through revisions and through, you know, this surge in taxpayer funded jobs growth, things turned around quite dramatically. So I wonder to what degree was that potentially a data issue with seasonality, etc., or to what degree the government has just put the hammer down further on that taxpayer-funded job creation.
Well, I think that's a good point. Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. So I think a lot of the data is partial and incomplete. It doesn't actually give us a good read. But I guess we might segue into the slides here that you're going to talk about, because one of the really interesting ones is what other sources of funds might households be tapping into?
Yep. Sounds good. Let's get into it.
Okay.
So as usual, the charts can be found at burnouteconomics.com, and we'll get straight into it. Now, this I think is a really interesting one because it just shows to what degree outflows from superannuation have become a major driver of economic growth. Now, way back in 2010, it was about 5.5% of household income, the equivalent was flowing out of super. It's now about 8.5%, and that's only going to increase over time because you're seeing people coming into retirement now who have had longer during the period of compulsory superannuation to build those balances. So I think it's going to be really quite interesting to see just to what degree the economy becomes even more reliant on the spending of over 60s, because if you look at the numbers, that is where the strongest growth is. And that's where the strongest growth has been now for almost 20 years.
Right. And it's just worth highlighting there are two issues here. The first is, of course, people moving into the pull down extract age. So in other words, over the retirement age and are pulling superannuation balances. The other is early access to superannuation. And there was some data released relatively recently that showed, in fact, there's been quite a spike in people effectively accessing superannuation earlier simply because they're in financial distress. So I think those two factors together are beginning to come together. But of the two, the first one is the most significant because, of course, as you say, people have now had significant time to be able to save within the super environment. And of course, pulling money out of super is tax-free as well at the moment. So up to a certain amount, although it may or not change that, I suppose, ahead. So this is a really big factor in the unequal distribution of income and wealth across Australia. And I come back to this all the time, Tariq, because averages mask. And, you know, the ABS data that they published this last week on the cost of living indices and were quite interesting insofar that the older cohort actually saw a slight increase relative to everybody else. You know, so that, in other words, their cost of living dropped slightly relative to everybody else who's seeing significant cost to increase rises. And those cost of living increase rises were greatest for those with mortgages. And I think the ABS reported that the amount of mortgage repayments and overall interest being paid had gone up by 14% over the last year, which of course is way above inflation.
Yeah, I like the cost of living index conceptually. But when the rental component is based effectively on a similar calculation or the same calculation as the CPI, I just find that it's not capturing the cost of living pressures being experienced by renters. Like, you look at your data, or you look at, CoreLogic's or Domain's or SQM's or insert data provider here, and that is not anywhere near the level of growth in the cost of people's housing that's being seen in the cost of living indices, which is a bit disappointing. I mean, I would think that the absolute gulf between the two, even when you sort of adjust for the fact that the current surge in rents has been larger than those seen in, say, the last 15 or 20 years, I understand it to a degree, but I think that there's a fair bit of work that needs to be done there. But to be completely honest with you, if you look at some of the best ABS data indices, things like actual growth in number in housing stock, or things like household disposable income per capita broken down by, sorry, household consumption per capita broken down by age demographic and a bunch of other different things, there's all these excellent data releases, and you look at when the next one's coming out and it says unknown. And that is just incredibly disappointing. And frankly, from a policymaking perspective, idiotic. Because if you don't know what's going on at a granular level across all these different households, how can you make policy, to sort of address that? I mean, I did that analysis a while ago that basically showed that people under 45, their real consumption has gone nowhere over the last 20, almost 20 years. And you'd think that would be a political emergency, but it's not.
No, and it's interesting because the ABS has stopped the monthly lending indicators series. So they're now only doing it every quarter. And of course, because it lagged, it's quite a long way. Now, the latest monthly aggregates from the RBA showed that mortgage growth was still extremely strong. And mortgage growth in the investment sector was extremely strong. It's almost as if that people want to sort of hide the immediacy of what's going on in some of these numbers by not producing them.
It's a frustrating set of circumstances because theoretically, the way that monetary policy is meant to flow through is it's meant to crimp credit growth. And ergo, through crimping credit growth, it's meant to slow the economy, slow aggregate demand, and then reduce inflation. But it hasn't crimped credit growth. You look at credit growth for investors, and it's these things are re-accelerating.
Yes.
They're not falling. This isn't like a traditional cycle. Like if you look back, I mean, I got I, someone in academia was kind enough to share with me a data set of the ABS lending series going all the way back to, I think it was the late 1970s. And if you look at it, you see it. You see the RBA raising rates, you see credit growth getting constricted, and then obviously then you see a sort of downturn in the economy, aggregate demand drops, inflation drops, then the RBA cuts, and you see the opposite. Yet we haven't had that during this cycle. We saw it for a while, but then, the rental crisis got worse, rents surged even further, and all of a sudden it was a great idea for renters to just jump into the market, and then FOMO, all over again.
Yes, and of course, the credit impulse is the one that I look at, and I've chatted with Steve Keen about this, quite a few times. That this is actually a critical element within the way the economy actually works, and in fact, the availability of credit is one of the strongest points of momentum. So, if in fact credit growth is still relatively strong and perhaps rising in some areas, then the question is, well, what is the implication of that? What it means is that people are getting more indebted. Not everybody, and this is the part of the problem. We've spoken about the bifurcation already, in previous shows, that there are some doing really well, and those with big superannuation balances probably doing quite well. Those with no mortgage and no rent probably doing pretty well, but those with large amounts of mortgage or large amounts of rent, not so much. And people are still actually being bounced into buying property and getting mortgaged up. But it is worth, I think, just standing back and thinking, well, what's all the impact of this? And it's hard to know, but one of your charts, which is really worth touching on, is the disposable income chart, right? Because the fact is that if you compare disposable income in Australia with other countries, we're not doing so well.
No, and that's a very nice segue. Okay, on the left here, we have household disposable income indexed to 2018 across a bunch of different nations, the OECD and the G7. Now, I just want to emphasize one thing. This is not absolute numbers. This is growth relative to where it was in 2018. That's been a, you know, sort of a bit of an issue with this chart. Now, as you can see, out of all the different countries and supranational organizations there, Australia is the only one that has seen real household disposable income per capita contract. Now, I want to just make one thing clear in terms of what this actually means. Now, real household disposable income per capita is essentially your take home after you've paid your taxes and after you've paid your mortgage. So it's affected by interest rates and it's affected by taxes. So the fact that Australia has issues with bracket creep, for example, is one of the issue, one of the reasons why Australia is struggling on this particular metric. But the reality is that we are behind both New Zealand and Canada. So New Zealand has an even worse issue with higher rates than we do. Canada has a much worse issue with migration diluting its real household disposable income per capita. Yet it's us who are faring the worst. And I think that that is really, I think that's really something. I think that's that should really be sort of something that gets discussed more, and just sort of how are we going to dig ourselves out of this big hole?
That's a very important point because, of course, the New Zealand unemployment rate, 5.1, this last week was significantly higher. They're talking about another recession in New Zealand. They've been cutting rates, of course, and that other chart, we'll put it up in a second, underscores that. But households in New Zealand are not doing as badly as households in Australia based on that particular chart, which is really fascinating. And I do think the tax take is a big part of it because, of course, the real tax take from households relative to corporates in Australia has really risen dramatically. And you can also see there the trajectory of policy rates. So we had a higher set of rates in New Zealand, the US, Canada, and the UK, and they're cutting. In Australia, we're still at peak, although the peak wasn't quite as high. Actually, we're mirroring perhaps more like Norway.
Well, that's the thing as well. I mean, the fact that we've fallen behind even the Kiwis and the Canadians, because, okay, Canadian rates haven't risen as much, but they've risen by more in New Zealand. And as you said, they've got higher unemployment. They've got recessions, you know, recessions plural, which is really something. And it's just, I find it just really quite fascinating that we are the ones falling behind the most. And something I just really want to emphasize about real household disposable income per capita is it's very, very, very difficult to grow. I know that that sounds sort of, you know, a little bit like hyperbole, but unfortunately it's not. Just earlier today, I was going through the numbers for real household disposable income per capita for Australia, going all the way back to the start of the data series back in the 70s. Now, on a rolling five-year rate, if you take the period of the pandemic and of the high levels of the expansion of household debt, which was 96 to 2008, and then the mining boom from 2008 to 2012 out of the equation, and the pandemic out of the equation, Australia's five-year growth rate of real household disposable income per capita is only 2.4%. That's it, over 5 years. So that's a fairly sort of pathetic effort. Now, if you then look at this chart and you think, well, how long is it going to take for us to catch up with the Canadians, for example, or the Kiwis? It's going to take almost a decade. And that is just nuts. And that's not exactly, you know, sort of streaking ahead with the Americans and the others who are doing a whole lot better. I mean, you're talking about a situation where we could be sitting here in almost 2040, you know, and we still haven't reached the artificial peak that we hit during the pandemic.
Well, I find
it's an absolute It's a wild situation.
Well, it is wild. And it's interesting because, of course, I quite often get people saying, well, but I thought Australians were the best paid in the world, you know, that our incomes are higher than anybody else. And I'm not sure that's any true. It may have been true sometime previously when there was a very small population and there was a significant momentum, particularly maybe through farming, et cetera, et cetera. But all of the data that I've seen suggests that, in fact, Australians are not doing anything as well as people think they are. But again, I want to highlight something else. Not everybody's in the same boat, right? Because there's a huge distribution, and this is part of the RBA's problem. There are some people doing extremely well with very big income growth and big investment portfolios doing well, and stock markets have been booming, et cetera, and superannuation. They're doing quite well. But a lot of other people aren't. And that's coming through in my data when I look at, for example, the proportion of disposable income going to pay for housing. So now we're seeing quite a few households with 40 or 50 or above 50% of disposable income going on housing. So, as well as the fact that, you know, disposable income has gone compressed, the cost of living, housing in particular, are also creating a huge well underneath many people. And that's why many people are feeling really frustrated, and why I think this election will be on the cost of living, but probably not cost of living on the true basis that we are talking about here.
It's interesting that you should mention that, because there was an analysis done by The Economist last year, and what it did is it took all these different advanced economies, and it had figured out in which economy were households the best off, basically. And the way that it did that was that it adjusted first for differences in purchasing power, because obviously, $100 in Australia is going to go a lot less far as $100 in insert country here. But basically, what and I something that they also did that I thought was very, very interesting is that they first adjusted for that, and after that, I believe Australia went from around, the sort of around about the top five to, I think it was about 16th. Then they said, okay, well, but households in different countries work different numbers of hours. There's different, so for example, female labor force participation rates. So obviously different households in different countries work different numbers of aggregate hours. And once you adjusted for that, Australia fell precipitously. It was either just outside the top 20 or just to around about the 20th. And all of a sudden you go, well, wait a minute, the Belgians and the Dutch are better off than we are, and it's really, quite something when you think about it from that perspective. It's like, yes, okay, well, we are wealthy in terms of you take our currency, convert it into someone else's currency, yes, but in terms of our ability to look after ourselves as individual household units, it's not so great. And
And
once again, as you said, that's at an aggregate level.
right, and the final point to make on all of this is, of course, that we have this wealth effect because of the booming home prices, and so those with a property will say, "Well, I've got this million-dollar thing that I'm holding on to," but of course, that is wealth on paper, and until you crystallize it and sell it, then it doesn't really mean much. And so you've got this sort of artificiality about the story, right? Which is that people still feel relatively wealthy, quote unquote, because of these high property prices and property prices accelerating. But in real terms, many households are actually not doing at all well. But again, we want to re-emphasize, not all households are in this boat. There are others doing quite well. And that's a problem for the RBA, right? Because the RBA is trying to sort of pick a single rate to try and best optimize across the bell curve. And yet you've got people who are in very different states of dress or undress across that bell curve. So it shows you, I think, the stupidity of the central bank strategy of saying, well, interest rates is the only lever I've got, so that's what I'm going to play with.
Well, it's interesting because I think that part of the issue is that, as you said, we've got to this point now where things are increasingly beyond the RBA's control in a lot of ways. And I think just the economy in general is increasingly beyond control without sort of far more targeted intervention by government. So I'll give you an example. You know, just like there was, we had the slide at the beginning of superannuation. That is now 8.5% annually of as it of household actual incomes. Yet you look at other things and you go, okay, well then you've got inheritances. In 2018, that was another 100 billion. And then you look at home equity withdrawals, and that in 2021 was almost another 100 billion. And in an economy where sort of household earnings are around about 1.1 trillion, and you're getting on for almost 300 billion, I would probably estimate that these days you're probably getting on for about 300 billion combined in just those three avenues. If you're the RBA, how do you manage that? You know, it's very, very difficult. I mean, like, I think that, and then not only that, but then you've also got the other lever that's getting pulled in the background, that's migration. And that's another sort of, let's call it, in terms of growth, you know, sort of 25, 30, 40, 50 billion a year, depending on exactly how hard it's being pulled.
Yes, and the intergenerational wealth transfer, the Productivity Commission did a report on that quite recently and highlighted just how big a factor this was. That's why we're seeing the bank of mum and dad, you know, in a very significant position now, despite the fact the RBA recently, I think when there were questions in Parliament, said, well, we don't really look at the bank of mum and dad as a factor. I think they should, because for me, that's a really, really important, you know, intergenerational wealth from parents, but also from grandparents transferring it down. That's helping quite a few people. In fact, there were a couple of articles over the last few days, including my research that got picked up in the media on that. So that's a big complexity there, intergenerational. And then this migration issue, and you know, the fact that we pump the economy by bringing more people in, which actually doesn't necessarily help per capita growth, but it may help overall top line growth, as we've discussed previously. All of those factors are in the mix here. So yeah, I agree the RBA has a complex modeling problem to try and actually figure out what's going on. But I have to come back to the fundamental question as to whether the simplicity of pull interest rates going one way and things go that way, pull interest rates the other way, things go that way. We're not seeing it.
Well, I mean, realistically, this is the point where, in an ideal world, in a sort of academic sense, the government should be taking over. They should be the ones, you know, tweaking policy in order to create the best possible set of outcomes for Australians as a group, not just we're going to help out, you know, the loaded, or the, you know, the sort of the elder boomers who have all the wealth, you know. And I think the thing is that, you know, it's very easy to sort of break this down into a sort of generational issue, and it is, you know, to a degree. But I think that part of the problem as well is that we're seeing this the rising issue of boomers renting, of retiring with debt. And greater and greater amounts of debt, much greater amounts of debt than their predecessors. And that's something that you recently did, I believe. I think it was for the ABC,
Yes.
you know, on how, you know, sort of people are retiring with much, much more debt. And I just think it's funny that, you know, these people that you're talking about are people who bought houses, you know, 20, 25, 30 years ago, and people who bought houses for much, much, much lower multiples than we did. Than you know, people in current generation are buying them for. And also, there's also the fact that they experience much greater levels of income growth than people in current generations are over a longer term time horizon. So it's just creating a massive long-term mess, but nobody wants to clean it up.
Well, of course, the banks love it because they actually are lending ever more, ever longer, and their margins are getting a bit compressed. But if you look at it in overall volume terms, because there's been such growth in lending, they're actually still reporting very strong profits, which is one of the reasons why CBA, for example, is significantly overvalued on any, you know, natural way of thinking about what the valuation of the stock should be. But actually, of course, the major banks are supported by government and government policy. And I've always believed that this credit impulse and the fact that the banks are lending ever more and ever more and ever more is one of those things about, well, who's pulling the strings? Well, in a way, the credit system is pulling the strings.
Yeah, unfortunately, Should probably move on to the next slide. Now, this is the slide of the rental inflation issue that I was referring to. Now, what I've done with this is that I've taken the data from the graph from the ABS and I've put it through AI in order to determine the actual underlying numbers. Now, they're not perfect, but it's relatively ballpark. But as you can see on the two middle lines there, the dotted red one is the CoreLogic asking rents. The blue one is the CPI rental component. They track each other relatively well. And then the black dotted line is the SQM research indices into asking rents. And the yellow is the actual rental CPI. Now, there's a few people that say, well, SQM's a little bit happy and we think that they are overestimating things. Now, I think that SQM is actually a very good leading indicator from where things will go in the future. However, I went through both domains numbers and CoreLogic's, and they arrive to pretty much the same spot in terms of cumulative rental growth within about 2 percentage points of each other. And it's also worth noting that part of that particular issue is the fact that they are reporting a little bit later. Some of them are only on Q3 data, while SQM is on Q4. So I think that it really just illustrates that something isn't working properly.
It isn't working as perhaps people think it's working, right? And that's the critical point. Interestingly, of course, if you were to do this at a more granular level, I think you would find quite significant differences in different states and also different types of property. Because one of the things I've noticed is that the rental growth for units is more capped because of people's capacity to pay. Whereas the rental growth for houses is still quite a lot stronger because actually quite a few people can afford to spend more and get a bigger property and pay a bigger rent. So I think it does, there's a lot of granularity which probably is masked in here. But clearly those simple relationships that people assume to be aren't.
Indeed, and something that's interesting, I'm not sure if it was the Grattan Institute or it may have been the Productivity Commission. I forget who exactly authored the report, but it basically concluded that you are seeing a much greater proportion of higher income people rent, which is skewing the entire thing in its entirety. And it's also just the fact that the renter cohort just keeps getting larger and larger. So it's all well and good to say, well, the average renter is paying X number of its income on rent, ergo things are fine. When that is now being skewed higher by the fact that you're seeing these higher income people who would have in decades past easily gone out and gone, well, I'm in the top 15% of income earners, I can easily buy a house. Whereas these days it's like, depending on the city, not so much.
Well, and the other factor that's really interesting, and I see it in my surveys, is that some of the houses that are being let are being let to multi-generational households, and that's partly the mix of different ethnic groups coming into the country, and also the fact that some of those have bigger households and are, say, multi-generational. So that's another factor. So the ability to be able to have multiple earners in a household allows them to pay higher levels of rent than normal. So you can't necessarily just assume, 1.5 or 2 times incomes. In some cases, we are seeing 3 or 4 or even 5 incomes going in to support that. And in some cases, there is a preference to rent rather than to own, which I think is also quite interesting. And that wasn't necessarily so predominant if you go back 20 or 30 years.
Well, it's a funny thing. It's funny you should say that. Like, if you look at some of these, sort of even just like, case studies I've looked at in terms of these multi-generational households, particularly multi-generational households where the parents still work, you've got these households that are on, that are skewing the data hugely just because you've got four adult income earners there, that are on, $300, $350, $400,000 a year. And obviously, that's skewing things into absolute oblivion.
Correct. And the census data, if you start looking at that, of course, the census data reports the average at a postcode level. But again, if you look at some of the other census data and look at the household mixes, you can see that in some cases, in some areas, there are big skews. So again, you know, when you go granular, you start seeing quite a different story.
Yeah, and just interesting little side note on this, the rise of the multi-generational household and people staying at home for longer is also skewing home ownership rates as well, because these people aren't going out. Because the thing is, when they calculate home ownership rates, it's about what proportion of people who are in independent households who are actually, you know, either own a home with a mortgage or own outright. But if you're someone who's still living at home with your parents, or you're living in a multi-generational household and you're not the primary person who owns the property, you don't get counted.
Spot on. Exactly right. And I'm seeing that distortion coming through in some of the survey work that I do. So once again, you know, the assumptions that people are making about the way that populations are working are somewhat flawed.
Indeed.
Again.
Now, I came up with this metric, I think it was maybe last year sometime, but what I've sort of wanted to determine was, is it possible for employment growth to run that much hotter than economic growth? Because realistically, economic growth and employment growth should be not in the same ballpark. You'd expect economic growth to grow faster, because obviously, you know, if you've got full employment and the economy is growing it, and obviously this is real growth, not nominal growth. If you've got the economy growing at, say, 3% and population growing at 1%, and, you know, you've got the workforce growing at a similar rate, then you'd expect, okay, yeah, about 2% growth of the economy growing about 2% faster. We've got a really strange set of circumstances now where the workforce or the number of people employed is growing much faster than the number of people, sorry, than the rate the economy is growing. And that is because we're seeing these jobs being created that are not sensitive to economic conditions. They're not normal private sector jobs where you got to look at things and go, well, I don't know, you know, the economy's looking a little bit dodgy at the moment. Maybe we'll hold off on hiring people. But when it's taxpayer funded, at least in some capacity, then all of a sudden you go, well, doesn't matter. Might as well grow the business. And that's exactly what's happening.
Right. Well, this comes right back to this concept of, you know, markets and non-market jobs, which Chalmers doesn't like that categorization. And he tried to explain it away, despite the fact that, of course, a lot of the NDIS jobs are actually in the private sector, but funded through the public sector, right, which, of course, masks a lot of it. And this really is the heart of the productivity problem that Australia has. And I'm always interested when people raise the question of productivity. In other words, what are we generating over and above just, you know, one job's worth of activity? And the truth is, at the moment, productivity is degrading rather than growing. And partly that, of course, is because some of the jobs, particularly in the care sector, aren't necessarily multiplying jobs in terms of economic output. But the question is, can that go on forever? Or is there going to be a point at which, you know, as that chart shows, well, then we go backwards, and if the economy actually isn't performing in a way that allows it to be sustainable. And that, of course, is funded by bigger deficits. And I note that after two small surpluses, Labour is now basically saying there's going to be deficits. And, of course, the other side probably won't necessarily do much to turn that around either.
No, and I think that it's interesting, because if you look at the numbers, we're heading for a situation whereby if current trends continue, by about the start of Q3, Australia will have more people in non-market jobs than the United States. And that's not including all Elon and Trump's Department of Government efficiency things either. That's based on pre-election numbers. So I just find that fascinating, that America, with its triplication of things across multiple levels of government, sometimes I'm not even sure what triple is. It quadrification? Is that the thing when you have four levels? Because, you know, you've got county, you've got municipality, you've got county, you've got city, you've got state, and then you've got federal. I mean, that might actually be five. But anyway, the point is that we've reached that point now where we've gone from having the lowest concentration of non-market jobs in the Anglosphere to having to rivaling who was the previous king, the US, on that. And if you give it maybe another, let's call it 2 years, we're catching up with the Brits. And at that point, I think that Britain has rather shown us that eventually you kind of hit a bit of a wall and limit.
Well, that's right. So the growth rate in the UK is continuing to fall. And the jobs mix is also pretty adverse in the UK too. And whilst they want to build their way out of this. So it's a build, baby, build in the UK now, right? Except that the planning rules and everything else will, still need to be turned over if that's going to happen. And of course, the lag is sufficiently long that it won't have an impact probably in this election cycle. So I'm afraid that the UK continues to dig a hole into somewhere rather dark and gloomy. Trouble is, I think Australia is digging a similar hole. I guess one day they'll meet.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we could make our own little, non-market job wonderland, right near the center of the earth. We'll call it Mordor.
It's been done.
Yeah. All right. Next, we'll move on to the next one. Okay, now this is from CoreLogic, and it details what the median dwelling value is and what a household can afford based on, excuse me, based on 30% of spending 30% of their gross household income on a mortgage. A series of rate cuts worth 135 basis points are going to help, but it's not going to help that much.
Yes. And the interesting observation here, and I track these affordability charts quite carefully because I think it's a really critical issue, is that there are two factors. Affordability here is measuring effectively what it takes to repay the mortgage, right? It doesn't take account of those other factors that we spoke about earlier on, which is that the disposable income is continuing to get compressed, which means a greater proportion of income is being required to be able to make this work. So there's a bunch of complexities here, which is, I think, worth underscoring, which is that even if you cut rates by 50, 100 basis points, it won't solve the problem.
I mean, realistically, I think they could probably cut rates by, I mean, this shows a fairly sizable rate cut cycle of about a third of the cash rate being cut, which is, to be honest, pretty sort of normal for historic cuts sort of post 1990. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of expectations that rate cuts are going to sort of unleash this demand, and I think to a degree that's true in certain locales. But I think in aggregate, it's not going to be anywhere near as helpful or impactful as people think it is. Not unless it's a lot bigger than what the market is currently pricing.
Although, of course, the journos were out over the last weekend spruiking the imminent property boom, which will emerge from rate cuts. Did you notice that?
When is there not an imminent property boom, though? Like
Well,
it's always just over the horizon.
yeah, correct. Exactly right. And I always remind people that a lot of the media is very strongly connected with the property portals who, may have a vested interest in continuing to get people to click through and look at property. So maybe that has something to do with it. I'm just saying.
Now, one of the interesting points people have been making recently is, okay, how much is the public sector and infrastructure construction, both for public corporations and governments sucking in labor from the construction sector? And also, how much is it costing us in terms of, the sort of broader sticker price? And as you can see, it's actually not that much higher now than it was under Scott Morrison. It's about 0.4 percentage points higher than it was under Morrison prior to the pandemic. Now, this is interesting, I think, for several reasons, because one, we do not have the labor force to be able to build the infrastructure. Now, we've got the workforce to build houses, and our workforce is pretty good at building houses, but building infrastructure requires a different set of skills a lot of the time. So there's this issue where we don't have the labor needed to build this infrastructure, but we need the infrastructure to support the population. But then We've got this sort of chicken and the egg situation. And basically, I think this just illustrates that we can't really solve the issues with a lack of infrastructure that we face through the current migration strategy, because it's just making the problem worse.
Right. But of course, what they can do is to write down some of the building standards and make it easier to build. In other words, build less good stuff. And I noticed that in Sydney, for example, they're talking about properties with no windows or properties with no, grounds, etc. It's like, well, we'll try and squeeze more into more areas. But this infrastructure issue that you're touching on is absolutely critical to understand. And there's some discussion about what proportion of new builds relates to the infrastructure required to support it. And it seems to me that quite often the infrastructure question is one that's not well understood and not well discussed, and yet it's so critical. So it's a fascinating element within this whole story.
It is. I mean, I think that if you look at it, say, for example, at a granular level, you often see these stories in the media, in particular in the ABC, to their credit. And it's about these housing estates. They're usually out in, say, Western Melbourne, southwestern Sydney. And these housing estates get built, and they're promised by the developer, oh, there's going to be a train station, there's going to be a freeway, there's going to be, three lane roads each way. There's going to be all this wonderful stuff. There's going to be shopping centers and schools and all this, and bus routes, and everything's going to be wonderful. And then it's not. And then you end up with these people in these housing estates that lack anything, in some cases, that lack anything beyond a basic shopping center. They like schools, they like childcare, they like all these sort of basic necessities of life. And I think that part of the problem is that when you take a step back and you look at that at a macro level, you think about these people living in some of these housing estates where, sort of 5, 6, 7, 10,000 people live in these large estates. And you look at that and you go, these people are having their productivity crimped. It's taking these bit they're driving down these crap roads, they're stuck in traffic, they're driving longer and longer to go pick up their kids or to go get some groceries or whatever it is. So instead of them being doing something productive or being healthier to be more productive, they're spending their time going off and doing all this other crap that they shouldn't have to be. So and I think it's true also at a sort of, if you take a step back and back further again and look at it, say, for example, at a city-wide level, you expand the population, you don't expand the infrastructure adequately, there's more people sitting in traffic, there's more people sitting waiting for a doctor, waiting for a surgeon at the emergency room. And all of that lowers productivity, which hits the economy, which hits wages, which just isn't good for anyone.
Right, two observations there. If you look at the number of tolls that Western Sydney drivers, for example, pay to get into the city and back, it's huge. Guess who's making the money there? And the other interesting observation, I see it in my surveys, that in Western Sydney, you need more vehicles to get around because there's no or less public transport, which means they're spending a lot more of their disposable income on just getting around. And that's putting more pressure on household budgets. And that's another reason why, in Western Sydney in particular, but not just Western Sydney, we are seeing financial stress and financial pressure being very high because the infrastructure isn't there, which means you have to actually find alternatives. Everybody, of course, is on the same roads at the same time, which means, of course, that you have huge traffic jams. As you say, productivity is reduced because of that. So the whole jigsaw puzzle of building livable places is missing in so many of these areas. And of course, at the end of the day, individual households end up paying.
They do. And I think that that's also just a sort of peripheral side note here is people say, well, why don't you go, people say to people in all across Sydney, why don't you go live in here or there or et cetera, where it's cheaper? But then you have to sit, like as you say, then you have to sit back and you've got to think, how much extra is it going to cost me in tolls? How much extra is it going to cost me in petrol? Because I'm going to have to go all these other different places now to be able to get where I need to go to get to work, to get to, pick up the kids from school or whatever it is. And once you add in all those additional costs, all of a sudden you look at things and you go, wait a minute, I could buy a house in a completely different place, and it would be the exact, it'd cost me the exact same amount of money.
Correct. Exactly right. Well, I lived at Thirroul for a long period of time, and a lot of people commuted from that area up into Sydney, but it's an hour and 20 to get into the centre of the city, morning and evening, right? So then you look at the, well, you might pay a bit less, but then you've got to actually spend a lot of time and effort to get to and from. Now, okay, if you're working remotely, then maybe that's not too much of a problem. But for many people, when you actually put all the puzzle together and work out what is it going to cost? What is the lifestyle trade-off that I'm making? It just doesn't work.
No. And I think that that's something that just sort of, that's something that needs to be considered when we sort of get, when we inevitably, not we as you and I, but we as a society inevitably get bogged down in that. Well, why don't you just move out to the sticks then, mate? You'll be sweet. It's housing cheap, everything will be fine. And it's not.
Oh, very good. Of course, the answer is high-speed rail, isn't it? Sorry.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, look, I love high speed rail conceptually. You know, when you're talking about places with, you know, say for example in Japan, I've been on the Shinkansen there. It's brilliant. I love it. But you're talking about a country where you've got massive population centers. Tokyo has the same, more or less the same population as Australia. So when you're running something from say Tokyo to Osaka and down to and then further down towards, you know, towards Hiroshima or Kobe or wherever, you've got these enormous population centers, and it's not that far in the grand scheme of things. Whereas if you look at Australia and people go, well, why don't we run from Melbourne to Sydney and then up to Brisbane? It's like because it's over 2,000 kilometers, and it would cost a shitload of money.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's one of those again policies that are announceables but never actually, never actually follow through. Well, we're coming towards the end of the show, but I know you've got a couple of international slides. Did you want to just touch on those?
Yeah, sure. We'll go through them rather quickly. I wrote an article a few weeks ago on Texas housing prices during the global financial crisis and basically asked the question, can a fairly valued housing market crash? And obviously, you can't make a complete blanket statement, but in the case of Texas, during the GFC, even though unemployment went up towards 10%, the answer was no. Prices actually rose.
Well, that just proves that property is the place to be. It never falls. It doubles every 7 years is the official view from many people that I survey. But of course, just look at it, right? You have to be in the right place. Can fall nationally.
Well, exactly. I think it just goes to show that if you buy in the right spot, you're all set. But if you buy in the wrong spot, then, you know, it's a bit of a different story.
Yeah.
All right, we'll just go to the last one. Now, with all the talk of tariffs, I went looking for a bunch of different data on basically how does the current cycle of trade wars and trade tensions resemble those of the 1930s? Now, thankfully, the US Department of Commerce has got all their reports going all the way back to the 20s, which was fantastic. And what I figured out was that basically the US had a trade deficit in most items during that period. It had a de deficit in semi-manufactured goods, it had a deficit in food and raw materials, but it had an enormous trade surplus, the biggest in the world in terms of manufactured goods. At the time, it was worth about 0.44% of GDP, of global GDP. Now, people are saying, well, if the America imposes tariffs, it's going to end up the same way as it did in the 30s. Well, no, because the US was reliant on exporting its excess manufacturing capacity to the world. Now they've been replaced by China, who's playing the same role, except their manufacturing deficit is almost four times larger relative to global GDP. So China is much, much more exposed to a trade war today than the US was when they imposed the tariffs, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs back in the 30s.
That's worth reflecting on, isn't it? Because I believe that the trades discussions haven't gone away. I mean, they'll mess around, but this is quite a significant factor. And of course, other countries could well get caught in the crossfire. And, I think of the UK, who's got one foot in the US and one foot in Europe and trying to work out what to do, or Australia with one foot in the US and one foot in China, China being the major export partner, it could be quite uncomfortable for some of those countries.
Well, it's interesting. I did a chart the other day. Basically, Australia exports more to China than its next seven largest trading partners combined.
Yep.
So, you know, if we really do see a sort of major bifurcation in the global order and global trade, and we're forced to choose a side, we've got a problem.
We'll go on fudging it as normal. Well, Tarek, I really enjoyed that conversation. Thank you very much. And my conclusion of all of this is that there are lots of strings around the place and a few tripwires here and there. But some of the simple stories that you read about pull this lever or do that thing is not really getting to the heart of the complexity that we're seeing. There's a lot of complexity and a lot of difficulty for a lot of people trying to make good decisions at the moment, whether you're a central bankers or, I suppose, policymakers or, you know, those stacking up for the next election. But the truth is that on the ground, not everybody's swimming well at the moment. And some of those pressures, I think, will come to the fore ahead.
Well, to quote Warren Buffett, I think some of them are probably swimming naked.
You're probably right. What a thought. Thank you, Tarek. Enjoyed that. And hopefully we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, sounds good, mate.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.